story. We have Brian picking up business. I'd like to recognize our recruiting secretary, Jenny Beer, and I have moderator, Alex Bailey. Thank you for being here this morning. Before we begin, please mute your microphones and silence cell phones. Remember to manually unmute your microphone to speak when we try to mute when done to keep background sound turned to on most of our online. Today, we are going to have a full agenda. We will hear a report on the Alaska Performance Scholarship Program, introduce House Bill 48, dealing with eligibility for the Alaska Performance Scholarship, get public testimony on House Bill 19, limited teacher certifications, and take public testimony on House Bill 25, social emotional learning. We will begin with a report on the Alaska Performance Scholarship Program, including recommendations and research findings. I'd like to invite McKinley Group Consultants Rebecca Braun and Heather Haugland to join us virtually this morning. Thank you. Here in the room, staff will advance slides, so please refer to page numbers or ask to advance slides as we go through the presentation. Now, welcome. Good to see you both. Please put your name and affiliation on the record and again.
I'm sorry, this will be back. Good morning, Mr. Sorry, you can be nervous. Are you guys getting feedback or just me?
I'm not getting feedback.
Okay. For the record, my name is Rebecca Brown, and I'm consulting with the Dream Research Group. Thanks so much for the invitation to speak to you today about the Performance Scholarship Program review and recommendations, which we recently completed for the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, and we call each other. I'm excited to be here today as well. If you can advance to the next slide, please. And today we plan to provide, I have to pull this up as well, I can't quite see your version. Today we plan to provide a quick overview of the Alaska Performance Scholarship and study purpose, go over some APS eligibility and use trends, share findings of surveys, interviews, and a literature review, and then summarize our overall findings and recommendations and take questions if you have them. Okay, next slide, please. The APS was approved in 2010 by the Alaska Legislature, and the statute notes that the purpose is to provide scholarships for high school graduates who are Alaska residents to attend a qualified post-secondary institution in state. That's all the language and the statute speaks to about the purpose, but the legislative record attests to a couple of different goals. A major goal stated by policy members was to drive increased K-12 rigors, who really push Alaskans to set high goals and achieve them, and then to keep high achieving students in state for school by providing this incentive. ACPE administers that's done separately, legislators did establish a $400 million higher education investment fund with hopes it would fund this and other scholarships, and of course this is a prohibition on dedicated funds. Next slide, please. The APS provides two types of awards. There's an award for degrees seeking students, often referred to as academic award, and a certificate award for career and technical education. About 95% of students using the APS are using it toward a degree for the academic award. There are three award levels. They range from the highest level, $4,755 a year down. Three eligibility criteria. Students have to have a certain four-year GPA. They have to get a certain score on a standardized test and take required coursework. They can use the award for 8 semesters and have to use it within 6 years of graduation and meet continuing eligibility requirements. Next slide, please. So ACPE noticed, over the last 10 years or so, a couple things. While there was a good feedback about the APS, and all the students were thrilled to be able to use it, the annual awards are significantly less than what policymakers had anticipated when they passed this program. And so fewer students have been found, fewer dollars have been awarded. And after peaking, overall youth has really declined pretty steadily since about 2016. And low use of the scholarship translates to missed opportunities for Alaskans and for Alaska as a state. So the question surrounding this study is why is EPS eligibility and use low and why is it falling? And what changes could help improve the programs that would essentially meet this promise? We were fortunate to have a variety of qualitative sources as well as quantitative sources to do this analysis, including annual outcomes reports that are required in statute. And we did executive interviews, particularly focused on post-secondary institutions in Alaska. We did a major study of high school graduates, a survey, and used a survey done last year in 2020 of school districts on APS eligibility, and we augmented that. We did a literature review. So it's really helpful to have all these different inputs coming in to help understand what's going on. Next slide. This is just an eligibility matrix. I won't read it. Some of you may be familiar with it. I think the key takeaway here is you can see it's fairly complex for students to navigate the different eligibility levels, eligibility types, required coursework, GPA, and testing. But I and there's voters have 27% overall average eligibility rate for that period. And groups below the line are qualifying at lower rates. And particularly, you can see Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander, Alaska Native, and African American students qualifying at lower rates. You can move to slide 12. So this one has an important little note. This is the increase in APS eligibility and race and ethnicity between 2019 and 2020. I mentioned that eligibility rose dramatically in 2020, and there was a key difference, of course, because of COVID, testing requirements were waived in 2020. So now only in 2 months of qualifying students have to still meet the grade point average criteria, and they have to meet the curriculum requirements, but the testing was waived. And eligibility rose dramatically, overall 63%. But it really varied by subgroups. And the groups that had the greatest gains in eligibility when the test was waived were Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander, African American, and Alaska Native students, which you'll recall were the same groups that were qualifying at lower than average rates. So this tells us a little bit about the test. Next slide, slide 13, please. Our district, the district survey that was done provided both qualitative and quantitative data. There's lots of it. Here we just pulled a few highlights for this slide. In terms of eligibility, districts reported that test scores were the top barrier to eligibility for their students. And the second barrier would be curriculum requirements. In terms of use, we heard that funding instability was a key concern for students and families, and that referred to University of Alaska funding and instability, as well as funding for the APS itself. There was in recent years a veto of the funding that some of you may remember, and while the funds for APS were ultimately restored, it did cause some panic and alarm among families. What we heard about from distances, some of that concern lingered. Thank you. all those numbers, but you can assume that there was this gradual increase in that number of respondents. So this points to a decrease in the confidence of the Alaska options, which Becca will talk more about. The response scholarship as a recent United States was mentioned by 31% of 2015 graduates, and that went up to 47% for 2020 graduates. And in a similar finding, financial aid package went from 16% of 2015 graduates to 30% of 2020 graduates. So these last two changes point to an increase in competitiveness of the out-of-state financial aid options, which again, you know, are corroborated by other study findings. Can you go to the next slide, please? Great. I also wanted to mention a couple of results from a study of the ineligible graduates. So among these graduates who said they were aware of APS, that's almost half of respondents said they were aware of APS during high school. One quarter said that they were very interested in qualifying when they were in high school, and another 46% said they were somewhat interested. So this points to the unmet demand. A lot of graduates would be taking advantage of this program if they qualified. And when we asked the graduates when did they qualify, the number one answer was test scores. So those are just a few data points from these surveys. There's a lot more data in the report if you're a data junkie like me. But in general, the surveys can be too clever what we learned in our other research tasks. I'll pass it back to Becca to talk about what we learned from universities.
Thanks. So moving to slide 16, here we just summarize some of our key findings from interviews, conversations with people at post-secondary institutions in Alaska. And I want to point out that the University of Alaska has looked at some of their data on APS students, and they know that APS students do show some higher outcomes, better outcomes in certain measures, such as higher readiness to take college courses when they arrive. Persistence, which is their rates of continuing from first year to second year, and higher completion rates. So there's certainly CBC some benefits by quality in their APS students. We have a lot to say about that was contributing to a decline or that it made it a little bit difficult for students to qualify for or use the APS. When was the complexity and burden of eligibility and program design, the timing of awarded applications, and because 4 years of grades and curriculum are required, students aren't notified about their eligibility for the APS until after they've graduated, often after they've made their decisions. I don't know if any of you have had a high school graduate in recent years. I have, but they are really here very increasingly early now from institutions all the way back to the fall of their senior year or earlier about scholarships and financial award from other schools. Declining real value of the awards because there's a fixed number in statute over 10, 11 years, that value has fallen. And continuing eligibility requirements were mentioned. A lack of flexibility between the career and academic awards. Some people mentioned that occasionally a student who's in the career track will find a passion or something in the academic track and want to get a bachelor's degree, but if they switch, they'll lose their award. Unequal access was mentioned quite a bit, particularly for rural students, being able to access the curriculum, test preparation, even test taking, can be a lot harder for students in some parts of Alaska than others. And then external factors are hard.
The declining real value of awards, the point that you just touched on, I just want to make sure that I heard it correct. The actual amount of scholarship is going down and declining, or is it just relative to the increase in tuition costs as well for the UA system?
Yeah, through the chair, thanks for that question. It's because it's declining, the actual number is not falling, but the relative value because of inflation is eroding.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for the clarification. We can move to the next slide, page 17. We did have original plans in the literature review, but our findings were we're so interested and we really wanted to learn more about the state of research and thinking, particularly about the role of test scores, since that was such a stark finding in our other research tests. overall, we found that recent literature tends to be finding that grades are more predictive than the SAT and ACT of college success. This is pretty striking and pretty surprising. But some major studies at the University of Chicago, University of California, and the Rocky University have both found this. SAT tests and ACT tests are having inequitable impacts and tend to serve as barriers to underrepresented groups. And finally, not too surprising given these first two findings, the role of the SAT and ACT is declining in higher education admissions and financial aid decisions. Hundreds of schools have gone to a test optional admissions policy, so students may submit their tests, but they're not required. And Florida is certainly accelerating this trend. Almost every school has waived the test requirements now. I think that's given a lot of schools an opportunity to reevaluate the role of the tests and whether they want to bring them back or not. If we could move to slide 18, I'll go over some of our key findings. Some of these are going to sound familiar, as we've mentioned already. But one thing I want to note is that our different research tests were really helpful, and they tended to corroborate narratives. Studies findings were often heard from students, or data back from school districts back from up. So overall, we found we believe there's high interest in ELTS among ineligible students, indicating unmet need, standardized test requirements are the top barrier to eligibility. And when the states stopped requiring students and paying for students to take a test, eligibility fell. We believe complexity serves as a barrier for some to eligibility, that the distinction between academic and CTE award is kind of unnecessary and can provide a barrier for some in terms of meeting their goals. There are significant disparities in eligibility by race and ethnicity in their region, and as noted, evidence is showing that tests are less predictive of student success than other factors, particularly GPA. Slide 19.
Ms. Brown, do you have a question for my props?
Please go ahead. Thanks for your question. I'm wondering if the last statement on slide 18 says that evidence increasingly shows that the SAT test is less predictive of student success than other factors. My question is, how is student success defined?
Thanks for the question. So I just first wanted to thank you for my question, and this is really the summary. I hope if you have an opportunity, you'll look in the report where we discuss this in a bit more detail. And it depends on the study. So the University of Chicago study specifically looked at all Chicago Public School graduates from a graduating class. They at this point did not require them to take the ACT, and they found that their grades, high school GPA, were 5 times as predictive as their ACT score in terms of their first year of college success, if I believe that were measured. There were some other studies that looked at looked longer term and looked at graduation rates and found overall, no difference in graduation rates when students came in test schools that had gone test optional. So there are a few different measures used in different studies.
Success more or less means completing college.
I'm sorry, I should say. In terms of when these tests are used, it's by secondary, post-secondary institutions who are looking at selecting students for admissions or for scholarships. So in this case, it's determined that success in whatever post-secondary program they've opted to do for students who are making different choices is not a measure of their success in life.
Success, if we were to state success as defined by the colleges, is completing the college curriculum. abstain from getting a college degree or staying in school more than past the first year.
Thank you, Robert. I think you're really quite quality information rights.
That appears to me that success is defined in this completed college.
That's the education program.
That's the education program.
Okay. I believe so.
Yeah, and if you don't mind me clarifying, there's an incentive for people who are giving an award, in this case the state, you know, like, we want our investment to pay off. So if they've decided that students are going to get an award for post-secondary education or training, we hope that they complete it. I think an underlying policy assumption. But the word success is kind of loaded, and I appreciate your pointing that out.
Thank you. I appreciate that, too, because I think part of the reason that we have put up with this program is for to have our workforce be filled with other levels of education for degrees to take the jobs that we have in the state. So I think that's the ultimate goal, is, and then also keeping our students are safe, because for every part of college, it seems like people have a chance to help their family better than we would want our students to sell in their own state. So, this is it.
Okay, thank you. I think we're on slide 19. APS use. We found some evidence that suggests APS competitiveness is declining compared to other financial aid packages, as we mentioned. We see some evidence that there's reduced appeal of in-state institutions, but that may be a contributing factor to declining use also. And the late timing of APS award notifications, as I mentioned, means that for some students it's not really part of their decision. And continuing eligibility requirements seem to be a little bit out of step with student needs and is a little not consistent with other scholarship requirements like university scholars. Moving to slide 20, we just share in terms of recommendations for grant principles from the Education Commission of the State. I won't read them. I think they are sort of good common sense principles to keep in mind for making changes to any kind of scholarship program. Slide 21, getting into our recommendations. First, we suggest simplifying program eligibility. And I've discussed some of these already, eliminating the distinction between academic and CTE awards to give student flexibility. Consider using alternative pathways to demonstrate academic rigor. But coursework isn't available in every district and every school, but you require coursework. And using 3 years of high school for eligibility determinations, that really goes to the timing issue that would enable awards to be made more commonly for students. And then consider round numbers for award levels, that was suggested. Simplify and increase the flexibility. Again, this was for continuing eligibility requirements. And consider extending this to 2 for APS use, given how many non-traditional students we have on offer. Slide 22, continuing, recommend working to increase access and equity in terms of access, and eliminating the testing requirement. This is probably maybe the most controversial, the biggest recommendation. I do note that this would effectively eliminate the distinction between the current technical tracks and the academic tracks, because the only difference in qualification is which tests students take. If testing remains a part of the qualification, we suggest a policy to require all students to take one of these tests and to pay for it so that everyone has the same opportunity to qualify. And then consider replacing staff certificate test scores with some kind of regulatory criteria. This is not considered kind of a technical suggestion, because the college board and its test makers sometimes re-trigger and recalibrate their tests, and then the meaning of a particular score can change. We suggest that all students have access to guidance, either to academic counseling in return, they can meet requirements, and to include separate analysis in any of our content reports. And then a sort of a consideration put a dollar value to the APS awards, at some point will need to be amended because, as noted, that value erodes each year with inflation. And to consider introducing some kind of statutory flexibility or formula or trigger mechanism so that you don't have to come back and revisit that number every few years.
Excuse me,
Mr. Chairman,
I have a question.
Sure.
I thought you said that under increased application commitment to equity lowered the testing requirement, and that would eliminate the distinction between CD and academic tracks. Will the curriculum limits be lowered between CDE and academic tracks because it doesn't accept any CTE classes currently if you're going out to get a 2-year or a 4-year degree?
Thanks. Thank you, Representative Story. That's exactly what we're hearing from districts and students and from universities, and also what national studies are showing. And that sort of feeds into the unequal access and feeds into our recommendation to remove the test as an eligibility criterion, particularly when you know that those tests really don't turn out to be incredibly useful predictors of whether students are qualified for the performing college or, I should say, whatever dream they have to move into.
And before I would like to bring up another student who loses their scholarship if they don't keep up their grade point at their university of choice, and so it does affect them a little bit if they put out a couple of days even. When they bring up the effect that their award becomes again. So I know the goal is to keep rigor and relevance both at high school and at Glenwood-Sickler in college.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Story. That's the continuing eligibility requirements exactly when it comes to keeping good grades. So,
but we have any questions about Hopkins here. And then I'll let you finish up and then we can ask questions. Thank you.
I think
we're going to be finished. Okay, thank you. I'll leave just the information and then we'll go to the next. We're just about down the left slide. I guess we just wanted to thank you for your time. I really want to thank ACPE as well for giving us the opportunity to do this study and asking these important questions. I just want to note, I think legislators really had a lot of vision when they created this scholarship, and they had some great ideas, and now with 10 years of experience, we have a lot of opportunity to refine and improve it and use this
incredible resource and asset as wisely as we can to make sure that Alaskans can get the full benefit and ultimately the state Alaska can get the full benefit of a trained and educated workforce in state. So thanks, and we'd be happy to take questions.
Yes, thank you for the presentation, Dr. Hopkins.
Thank you for that presentation to both of you. It was really beautiful. Let me back up slide 10. We had the percent of public school students eligible for the Alaska Performance Scholarship graph on the left. And looking at the number of students who are eligible, I know it went over the test scores quite a bit, and that's certainly not a big deal. Player into the eligibility, as you said, there's many of these students were the anecdotes in the slide 13 said this is the first time that a student has ever taken a time at the test in one of these schools. But looking at where the lowest eligibility scores are in Southwest and Far North of the school districts, how much of that did you guys feel the availability of the required course load and course requirements for being able to get funded as opposed to just the test? Did they have enough math classes? Did they have enough science classes? Those sort of things.
Thanks, Chairman Hopkins. The study, I'd love to point you to a study that was done in 2020 that interviewed some of the survey districts and got both data and qualitative feedback. And we did hear from a lot of rural districts that the curriculum requirements were a big challenge for some of their students to meet. The sort of relative, which is the most challenging in some of those rural districts where you see the lowest eligibility, they've had dual challenges of test access, test prep, and access to curriculum, as well as, in some cases, access to the support they needed to make sure that over those 4 years they got every class they needed. And in some cases, I mean, it really takes some extra doing in some places to sign up for an online class where there wasn't enough curriculum. So I would say curriculum was a major contributing factor on limited curriculum in some of those rural districts.
Yes.
Thank you. I agree with that as well, so I'm glad that unfortunately that is another double or triple whammy for equitable access to the scholarship. In terms of your study and your recommendation at the end, were you looking just specifically at the standardized test scores for the ACT and SAT, or do you have any recommendations looking at that current criteria as well?
Thank you. It's really clear what happens. Your short answer is no. We are sort of just passing on a lot of the feedback we got that the curriculum criteria should be reconsidered. It would take some work because we, like you, I think, don't want to lose the rigor. We don't want to lose those high standards. But we do want to make sure that there's enough flexibility that students across the state can access it. And I think that would take a little more thinking. We're not quite ready to say exactly how that should be done. And of course, I'll check too, if you put these recommendations together and you move to 3 years of curriculum, you're going to have to reduce the curriculum requirements, of course, anyway, since you're just looking at the students' first 3 years of high school. So no, we're not quite prepared recommendations on curriculum changes at this point.
I appreciate that, and the timing of the scholarship will certainly be an interesting point. Thank you very much.
Any other questions for our presenters this morning? Dr. Thurman. I'll be back to slide 4 on the award levels. Have those award levels stayed the same over the life of the Performance Scholarship Program? Whatever, in 2012 or whatever year it began, was $4,755, and it continues to be $4,755 in 2020.
For the chair, Dr. Lund, the answer is yes. Those award levels are set like that in statutes.
scholarships. And that started the legislature and the governor. But I don't have a chart in front of me, but that would be really helpful in this analysis in terms of amounts available for scholarships. A lot of the money from this reinvestment fund has been frittered away or upgraded in topics and fostered good causes, but there is not as much money available to produce revenue for these scholarships as there was at the start of the program. And the fact that the award laws have stayed the same, legislature made a mistake about allowing for inflation to cover those levels. I know it's, I want to say it's probably $15-17 million available each year. So as the cost of college increases, the cost of the value of the scholarships and the grants does not increase. So naturally, they're going to be more competitive in other places.
Thanks for bringing a few questions there, I think. So first, is that part of our scope of work to look specifically at how much money that higher education fund is earning and how that plays in? But we're certainly aware of that. And overall, it's been about $9 million a year that's been paid out in scholarships. So it's still, it is below the level that's anticipated, I think below the level that could be afforded. And it's certainly, I think we've all observed, there's some use it or lose it stuff that goes on in the legislature. And I think that if we don't use this asset, it may be right for poaching.
Right. Okay. On slide 8,
Just
to talk about the percentage of public high school graduates eligible for the APS, not the actual numbers. What does 29% mean? What does 29% mean in 2011? Is that 2,900 students or is it 5,000 students? And then when you go to the next graph, where the percentage of students, of eligible students, actually using the APS, again, what is 36% of the 29% on slide 8, which doesn't have an actual number attached to it in terms of the number of students.
Thanks. Thanks for the question. Yeah, we sort of debated what numbers and how many to share. I apologize for didn't share those numbers. They are in the full report. We have those numbers. And I could take a minute and try to figure out which page to direct you to the report.
Excuse me for a moment, Ms. Brown. It might be out of your misunderstanding. On page 9, APSCs, it says 844 students above the 36%. Did I read that correctly?
Yes.
So that 844 you said there, and then that was 644 in 2019.
Right. Yeah. And Representative Simon, on the full report on page 13, we do have the numbers, and I can just quickly answer your question. Going back on slide 8, eligibility. In 2011, the number of eligible high school graduates was 2,338. So, and then that was 29% of us. 36% of those eligible students decide to use it, and that came out to 844 students.
And also, we can, of course, send questions into the broadcast room for their feedback, because I'm probably going to be more of them as we go along the reports.
Thank you. Coach, your story. So, I understand you to say that the amount that we're not utilizing the amount of funds that is available, is that correct?
Thank you for the question. It's kind of a tricky question because, of course, the higher education fund is not a dedicated fund. So it's hard to say exactly what amount is available. The amount that's available is really the amount that the legislature appropriates.
Okay.
One thing we do with that is look back at fiscal notes and calculations made at the time that this program was adopted. And legislators anticipated spending a little bit over $20 million a year on the awards once it was fully phased in. And those awards never exceeded about $9.4 million per year, I think, since adoption.
I guess we could say that the capital, the underlying capital in that fund is underutilized. There is capital in a fund, I'm assuming, right?
I think that's a fair conclusion to draw.
Thank you very much for your time, everyone, this morning. It certainly gave us a lot to think about in such a presentation today. And we, I'm sure, will want to talk about this further, too. So, appreciate that very much. So, I'm going to take a brief ease and pass the gavel to Edward Bryant, as I'm going to do with prepared to approve the House Bill 48. Back on the record, let's now move to House Bill 48, eligibility for the Alaska Performance Scholarship. Representative Sturry and her staff are going to introduce themselves and present the bill to the committee. I'm Stephen Drummond, and members of the House Education Committee. For the record, we have Andy Sturry, representing District 34 here in the Mendenhall Valley. I thank you for coming this bill. It's been clear in our conversations last week and longer that career and technical education is a highly valuable part of the secondary education. We think so that learning experience keeps them engaged in school and gives them a meaningful path to their future work, education, and goals. Last semester, I introduced this bill and was received with enthusiasm from the career and technical education community. However, during the late start and COVID really set down, the bill did not move far enough. This year, I reintroduced the bill as it is a first step towards recognizing the value of CTE in well-rounded various sports of study. Just this morning, in light of the recommendations and research findings you just heard, I would just like to consider whether or not to integrate some of the report's recommendations into the bill, and I look forward to everyone's thoughts on this and continued conversations as we move forward. With House Bill 48 in front of you, Tim, very briefly, it offers students three options to choose from when applying CTE coursework towards Alaska Performance Scholarship eligibility. It broadens very modestly the range of courses a student can count toward APS eligibility. It really recognizes the value of CTE for all students who meet and advance in Alaska's future workforce. The performance scholarship is an important financial resource for many students. I'd like to see more students have access to these resources, but I want to be sure that students who are interested in CTE options alongside academic work are those count in this scholarship. Today, I'd like to present the bill for your consideration, walk through the bill packet, and hear from the Alaska Board Secondary Education Committee. That role with the Department of Education is available online to answer questions. I appreciate your time and consideration on this. It's going to be great to work together on this important opportunity for our students. And we've asked my staff, Mary Heffler, to walk you through the bill packet. And we do have some invited testimony. And feel free to answer if you have any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Thank you.
certainly have one very gift fire today. So that you heard the conversations on the Dean screen. Sarah, can you hear me?
Good morning. Richard,
Reconciliation of the record and help us for the actual training.
Yes. For the record, my name is Sarah Eford. I'm Executive Director for the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. Thank you, Petra Drummond and Soy, and members of the committee for the opportunity to be with you today. This HB 48, which would expand the eligibility requirements for the Alaska Performance Scholarship to include a high school career and technical education pathway, is very important to the Commission. The Commission is very aware of the need to expand CTE opportunities in Alaska and supports CTE as an integral part to the future success of our Alaska students in our state. This change places equal value on CTE career tracks as an option for post-secondary education. If passed, HB 48 will allow more Alaska students the opportunity to be eligible for the APS and would specifically expand options for high school CTE students. Creating this high school pathway aligns with the existing APS CTE award. And as Ms. Hartford just stated, a CTE pathway is becoming increasingly urgent based on the data that she just shared and that the Alaska Teen Network is working toward 65% attainment rate because Alaska's best jobs will require some type of post-secondary credential, including the high need for Alaska workforce with CTE credentials. HB 48 is a positive step forward in expanding CTE opportunities for Alaska students to help meet the upcoming needs of our workforce. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Eford. Questions for any of the presenters? It sounds like this is meeting the recommendation to call the utility group, which is presented. They did say increased availability of CTE awards and make them more equivalent to the academic awards. So I'm happy to see this. And I'm remembering this from last year. It's a long time ago.
I'm talking in my mind when you look at the permanent on this level and the potential deal with the Alaska Performance Scholarship, and you see the greater that is enrolled. How many of these art classes are required for us to graduate from our high schools? When you see the four classes of science required for math or social studies, which again are standards to your CTE and you go down each of the qualifications. When I think about the recommendation to eliminate testing, you can see that there is still rigor depending on your GPA counts too. So if you just think about taking away the testing, I think you still are going to have rigor in this program and it would honor our students far more. So I just wanted to point that out as we think about the recommendations that we received from the report this morning. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you for this really timely piece of legislation. I was looking at section page 2 of the bill, section C. And can you just refresh my memory on the adjustment being made here with respect to I appreciate the acknowledgement of the need to make the performance scholarship more equitable and public. I think that's one of the most striking takeaways of this morning's presentation. And I just wanted to acknowledge that the intention of this particular section.
I'm sorry, Marcel, we wanted to talk about the career clusters of the UGC. I'm sorry.
So I'll go ahead and send Brad to the lab for the district. Just go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. This morning, it's representing the whole commission record office for the surveys. I just wanted to quickly go over the fiscal note that you all did have on your desk before. In the spirit of self-explanatory, and it did come down from the version last year that we had to the same legislation. That's because we all learned that we can do things virtually now. So, as you can see, there is simply a one-time increment for creating these standards, bringing people together, $30,000 for 20 educators around the state to come together for 1 year to create those standards and figure out what law student can use them through that experience, $1,500 for each 20 of those educators being members of the professional college, $35,000 for a contract for a national FDL expert to help facilitate that standard process so that they are able to help lead that law student in dialogue. And finally, $6,000 in legal fees to implement the necessary regulation changes, which is something we saw in the previous bill of fiscal note as well. And that's the rundown of the fiscal note. What we're having, you can see in that second to last paragraph of the description of the fiscal note, that it would be done virtually so we don't need to pay for food and beverages and rental costs and things like that. So that is the main reason that the fiscal note is about 30% lower than it was last year.
Thank you. Any questions on the fiscal note for Representative Hopkins? Seeing no questions, I believe you have some invited testimony this morning.
Mm-hmm.
So we have three individuals. I'd like to invite Allison Sibylk to join us, and please state your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you.
recorded testimony, and I'm going to open it to the public testimony. So, same online. We have some testifiers. I'm going to ask for a testimony to be about 10 minutes. And please put your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony. And we're going to now start out with three votes. Yes, very good. Nice voting there.
Correct implementing it, but I'm trying to create standards.
school, we can teach reading, writing, and arithmetic for the rest of the world of the day on the map.
Appreciate the fact that for bringing it, and
even more critical than the grassroots. So we start with creating the pipeline and the Department of Education, creating, developing, and adopting regulations necessary to implement the changes we need for social emotional learning in Alaska. And we fully support this bill and hope you'll give it further consideration. Thank you so much for your time today, and also thank you for your service.
Well, thank you for your testimony. Any questions for this employer? Well, seeing none, I will look you online. I do not see anyone else in the queue, but I will ask if there is anyone else online who would like to testify on House Bill 25. Hearing none, and seeing none in the room, I'm going to close public testimony on House Bill 25. Do any committee members have comments or questions?
Thank you, Chair Stein. I guess my concern with this bill is that we're asking the school, and actually the state, to set standards for skills that normally were taught through by parents and through Sunday school and churches and organizations like that. And as I read through these standards, I'm concerned that the state is delving into what I would certainly consider religious training. It's not that it's bad, that's certainly not the case, but it's on different objectives. And then I'm also concerned just looking at the standards that were presented here. I believe they were from the Latsun School District, when you try to accomplish this at a specific age, that children might not be ready to be dealing with this stuff, or might be creating more problems than were solved. Think very, very carefully before we get into this business very much further. And I guess my recommendation is to encourage parents and teachers to take on this, but I don't know that the state is obligated to do that, or should be doing that.
Thank you for your comments, Director. Do we have other committee comments at this time? Thank you.